campaign, Say Her Name, just really inspired me. And I wanted to come up with a tool that I could use to express how I felt when you look at all these women who are also being murdered by police, but they're not in the media in the same way. And I wanted a song that was heavy enough to convey the pain and the emotion, but also be rooted in the history of Black people in this country. And so I wanted to sort of resample the Black National Anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing, and include it in that, singing it in a different melody and a different sort of cadence, but sort of connecting Black women to that history, so that we remember that when we're talking about Black people, that we have to talk about Black women as well. I am a singer-songwriter by night, so to speak, and I have a regular sort of day job that I do. But over the course of the last couple of years, I've been sort of trying to figure out the role of the artist in society, particularly Black female artists and particularly Black female sonic artists. And so I've been sort of reading and researching and writing, and joining AAPF comes at a really great time for me, just sort of figuring out what my role is as an artist. And I see Say Her Name, the song, as a great tool to be used by an organization and by a community to shed light on an issue that we need to shed light on. I believe strongly in the power of arts to speak to power, the power of arts to connect us, one citizen to another, one global citizen to another, and the power of, particularly, and I'm sort of biased, to the human voice, the power of that voice to remind us of our humanity and other people's humanity. And so that leads me to the AAPF, and being the artist in residence is an awesome place to be, where you can lift your voice and know that it's being done for something that's important, and something that is sorely needed in our society.
Hi y'all, I'm really thankful that Abby is here. I am not an artist myself, that is not something that I was gifted with, but art is really important to activism and to the movement, right? You know, we look at this wall right here behind you guys, or to the side here, we see a wall, we see a barrier. And the artist sees, oh, I can put a mural on there, I can tear it down and make a monument, I can build steps over it, right? The artist sees what's possible that other people can't. So I'm really thankful for Abby being here and the work that she's doing. I'm an organizer. My official title is Director of Community Engagement at AAPF, but I've been organizing for about 10 years. I got my start around in North Carolina, where I'm from, doing police accountability work, after witnessing my cousin shot and killed in front of my home by a police officer. I then went on to get engaged more in police accountability work in East North Carolina. And there was a particular story I remember where the cops were called out for some kind of drug bust. And the young man was in the front yard. They shot him. They didn't kill him, but they shot him. And they went inside, and one of the officers assaulted the girlfriend in the bedroom. And I remember at the time us rallying around the shooting of this young man, right? But none of the civil rights groups, none of the churches, no one had a sort of framework or way to talk about the sister who was sexually assaulted in the bedroom by a police officer, right? They were like, oh, we don't know what exactly to do with this, which kind of led me to do more research around Kimberly Crenshaw and intersectionality. And I would actually remember this again when I was in Ferguson a few years ago, doing organizing work down there, where I would run across AAPF and their brilliant work. I wanted to show you guys a slide, but I'm going to have to pass around my computer, just walk around. Is that cool? Yeah. All right, y'all can see this. So what is this a picture of? Can y'all see this?
Cows.
Cows. Can y'all see these cows? A field. Cows in a field. Can y'all see this? Yeah. All right, let's imagine these cows are sick. Why might the cows be sick? Who's responsible for the cows being sick in this picture? The farmers. Anything else? the grass, something could be wrong with the grass. But the farmers, right? They're responsible for the wellness of the cows, for making sure the cows aren't sick. Okay, now let's look at this picture. Now, why might the cows be sick?
Pollution.
Pollution? What's back there? Factories. It's a different frame of understanding. So the first picture I showed you is sort of this colorblind way of looking at racial injustice and inequality, right? It looks at the very individual level of the farmer. Something is wrong with the cows because of the individual responsibility of the farmer, right? But when we zoom out, we see that it's much more systemic, right? It's much more rooted in community responsibility, right? There's some kind of injustice going on there with environmental issues as to why the cows are sick. And so we're getting to this kind of contemporary understanding where people are talking more about institutional racism. They're talking more about systemic racism. We even heard Hillary Clinton say systemic racism at the first presidential debate. That's kind of amazing to hear, right? So we're kind of now getting to the idea that racism isn't just this individual thing, right? It isn't just the farmer and the cows. It's this institutional systemic thing. But we're still missing something from our framework. Before you took this class, by show of hands, before you took this class, how many of you heard of Mike Brown? Many of us probably heard of him, right? How many of us heard of Eric Garner before this class? Okay. Now, how many of us heard of Tariqa Wilson before this class? How many of us heard of Maya Hall before this class? Okay, a few people. How many of us heard of Eleanor Bumpers? What's the difference between those first set of names where everyone's hands was up and the second set of names? Gender. And let me tell you that this isn't something that is new. We do this exercise with a bunch of groups, and every time we do it, we make people stand up, and by the time we get to all the women, everyone's sitting down, right? And it isn't from a lack of care. It isn't that necessarily that we just don't care about black women and girls, right? It isn't because you guys don't care about what happens when a little girl is shot and killed by a SWAT team member at 3 o'clock in the morning, right? It's that the frames that we have for understanding racial injustice and police violence aren't there, right? Communications experts say that if you don't have a framework by which to understand stuff, you can't accept the facts. In fact, you can't even see the facts if you don't have a framework to which and to understand anti-black state violence as it relates to black women and girls, right? People want to know, is it police violence? Is it anti-black state violence? Is it violence against women? And it's both, right? And that's what intersectionality means. And this framework is important. It's important for us to have these frameworks because if we don't, we lose people in the obscurity, right? And we only talk about half the problem, right? And so when we don't have these frameworks, policymakers aren't talking about us, right? Protesters aren't saying our names at marches, not intentionally, but they aren't, right? Politicians sure as hell ain't leading with our names, right? And so we go missing through the cracks.
And researchers aren't collecting data. Mm-hmm.
And researchers, yeah, exactly, aren't aggregating data that is talking about gender and race. Mm-hmm. It's like all the men are black, all the women are white, right? Or all the black people are men, and all the women are white women, right? And so we are missing then the particular ways in which black women experience state violence. And so let's talk about some of those forms. I really want us to kind of have a dialogue back and forth. Let's talk about those forms. So we understand it when we see Mike Brown shot and killed in the streets, right? We understand it when they are killed doing their jobs, either selling CDs or cigarettes. We understand it when they're stopped and shot in their car. But there are other frameworks that we should be thinking about when we're talking about anti-black state violence that we traditionally don't think about, that are specific to black women. What might some of those frameworks be? When I say that, what are some ways black women experience anti-black state violence or violence at the hands of the police?
There was that case last year with Daniel Holtzclaw, that mm-hmm. policeman who was arrested and then actually convicted of mm-hmm. raping or sexually assaulting primarily black prostitutes and or drug users while he was on the drug.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Corinne Gaines, I think, is a very important, because I think people still, you know, combat the that she should have gave up her child or she should have let the police officer in it, and it's this, and they don't think about the systemic violence that a black mother faces by seeing what goes on in the news and what seeing, you know, what that role is as as a black woman.
Good. What else?
This is something that we read in the Kimberly Crenshaw article for this class, which is that a lot of like law enforcement and organizations don't know how to respond to black women and women of color who are facing domestic violence. I think one of the kind of most chilling examples that Crenshaw gave was that there's a woman who needed to be in a shelter, and she couldn't speak English, so she was kind of denied entrance, and the person that was trying to get her into the shelter, she kept saying, you know, like, we can do all these things to try to, like, work around the fact that her English isn't very good, and the people just did not want to work with that.
I also think when someone's in, like, a mental health crisis, a lot of people just don't know how to deal with that.
What else?
The sexuality of black women will be criminalized, particularly trans black women, with, like, so much as just possession of a condom is used as evidence of prostitution.
Yes, right here.
I mean, there's the economic structures, like gendered economic structures, that create situations that lead towards state violence. Like, you know, when there's a pay gap, that creates, you know, a gendered economic pressure that obviously would be translated down the line into lived experience.
Yes. These are good. We're going to keep going, but I want to come back and frame some of these, because I heard some really important stuff with the officer who sexually assaulted and raped 13 women, and we talked about the condom bill. Right? And so when we think about historical frameworks by which we can understand this particular piece around anti-black state violence, we think about the Jezebel, right? The Venus Hottentot, the sexual deviant black woman who deserves whatever she gets, right? And it's a very old antiquated trope that we see in these very old time movies, and we think it's something that we've kind of moved away from. We're beyond that, right? We've progressed many years past understanding and seeing black women as these Jezebels, but we see that institutionally, systemically, that our, the way our law works and the way police interactions work, if we think about the Jezebel, we think about one way in which black women are specifically targeted, criminalized, victimized, brutalized, and then put into jail, and then also misgendered, right? And now let's pivot back to Gaines and the mental health crisis, right? We think about the angry black woman trope, right? And how no matter what a sister does, she's angry, and therefore whatever violence we interact with on her is warranted. There's a sister, Michelle Cuso, who was killed a few years ago in Arizona. She was having a mental health crisis in her home. The officers came. They were supposed to come in and you know, give her some assistance, take her to the hospital. Instead, they shot and killed her. The officer said, and I quote, that she had a look on her face that seemed menacing. That was his reason for shooting and killing the sister. Again, harkening back to the angry black woman trope and seeing us as inherently violent, right? Sassy, right?
Sandra Bland.
Too much mouth. Need to be put in our place, right? But when we talk about it, most people think of it as like, oh, the endangered black man is the only person that they see as predatory. And we can cite these examples in these case studies where that's not the case, where black women also experience being deemed and seen as inherently violent and angry, right? So what are some other ones? We talked about the Jezebel, the angry black woman. There's some other frameworks. Yes.
Like, she was arrested and she fired a warning shot. But I think there's this idea that, like, black women, especially, but just, like, women in general, like, deserve the violence that is put on them. And that, like, even when they try to defend themselves, they shouldn't be, because the violence is expected. And, like, violence against women is it's just the side of society.
So who gets to stand her ground? Their grounds.
Also, invasive strip searches of black female bodies or gender non-conforming bodies being viewed as vessels for the drug trade and hiding drugs, and then people being victimized in public and humiliated.
You guys feel free to jump in, too. You don't have to raise your hand.
Also, black women as collateral damage to, like the main target. Like, even looking at the Corinne Gaines situation, they were looking for her boyfriend or whoever. And, like, besides the fact that she was, like, I don't know, like, crazy and whatever else they want to say about her mental stability, like, part of the reason why they felt that they could do that was because, like, she was blocking them from their big target.
Also, like, the angry black woman that is masculine, I guess, like, a lot of the portrayals of, like, Michelle Obama and, like, certain cartoons that have been drawn about her, depicting her with, like, a penis and, like, big arms, things like that.
That's really important. That's really important. That's a really brilliant connection.
Okay. Black women as having superhuman strength and no pain threshold.
That your point sort of just made me think about, like, how you see in, like, with certain movies and media, like, how black men often portray women, like Madea or what's the other one with Martin Lawrence?
Big Mama.
I mean, I think that's also something that sort of coins the stereotype as, like, black women being masculine.
There's another hand over here. Go ahead.
I don't know if it's a stereotype, but I also feel like with immigration, so, like, there was Marima on the Afro-Durham movie, and she's been in a different detention center for a long time, and, like, black immigration is often not maybe in the mainstream as much, but, like, that's also a way where, like, women are kind of criminalized just by virtue of being immigrant.
I'm not sure this is a stereotype as much as an expectation, but a few weeks ago I attended a critical black feminism lecture, or panel, at NYU, and it's something that they discussed that hadn't occurred to me, but seems, you know, very interesting, and something I had to consider was that there's an expectation of black women by black men to be martyrs for the movement. You know, in an instance of domestic violence, is disencouraged to report it to state actors, or in the obvious, understandable circumstance of distrust of state actors, any actors, due to playing into the perception of black men as black.
Y'all feel free to jump in, because I see y'all really want to pop off on this one.
Yeah, so it's just like, I mean, kind of going off of that, it's like that, like, black women are at the disposal of black men and everybody else, that they are the kind of mammy for all, like, it's kind of like this sort of, like, kind of with, what was the book? I can't think of it right now, but, Gone with the Wind, how they're always the caretakers, and they have to assimilate to this caretaker type aspect always, and cannot question. And so it goes to this problem of, you know, black women have to draw the line somewhere. Like, they have to put themselves over over other people, because they aren't being respected in that same category.
Well, also, like, in the same regard, like, just the, sorry, I'm, like, so lost in this right now. Like, the fact that a lot of times, to combat the stereotype of the angry black woman, the black community, particularly black men, but a lot of black women given to it too, is, like, you know, the strong black woman who like, takes care of her family, stands up for her values, her beliefs, but, like, all in service of something that's not herself. And, like, it's a role that is very, like, self-sacrificial, a martyr, and, like, it's just very unhealthy. And, like, we read something in the Kimberly Crenshaw article about how, like, specifically the Mike Tyson rape case, how, like, Desiree Washington came forward as one of his black rape victims, but no prominent black leader said anything about her, because, like, there is this history of black men getting accused of rape by white women, and that seems to be, like, like when a black woman comes forward and accuses a black man of rape, she's demonized because of that fact, and like she's bringing down the black race somehow by like sharing her own personal experiences.
So we have, I'm gonna go this way. Is that cool? Here, 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 and then here. Go ahead.
Cool. I think, and I think that like role of the martyr extends to being like a caretaker of the movement, and that like when, you know, like it is black men's names who are being said at the rally, but it's not necessarily black men who organized the rally. More than likely, it's their mothers and sisters and like who, you know, held the vigil, who like who organized everything, and so. Like, that role of martyr, I think, in the community also makes them sort of this collateral damage for state violence and the fact that they are left to pick up the pieces when the black men who were killed at the hands of police are being honored.
So I'm hearing a lot around the martyr, right, and the mammy robe. Also embedded in this is kind of the ride or die, right?
Well, I was just going to say off of that, I think what Crenshaw points out in the article is that these sort of systems of oppression and this power hierarchy ends up being replicated, like, within, like, anti-racist, anti-sexist movements, which I think is just, I don't know, I like that especially because it helps you really, like, sort of contextualize, like, how is it that all black lives don't matter within Black Lives Matter, you know? So, yeah.
Here, here, and then here. I see you.
I was also going to say that I'm getting the sense that like white men very much have a direct benefit from like encouraging like this idea that like black men own white own black women and like have ownership over them, because white people, white men specifically, own black people. So if this person is owned by somebody who's already below you, then that means of course you can abuse them, of course you have access to them, you can, like, use sexual, physical, emotional, labor wise, like, so like take it back to like pay back on whiteness. White men encourage like black men.
Yeah.
So the importance of connecting like structures, racism, patriarchy, and how they work to support and bolster each other.
So the ratio of black women is very much benefits than white supremacy, right? All right. Here, then we're gonna sweep this way. Go ahead.
It just seems to me that there's the specific struggle of the black woman is a unique deprivation of community resources. That like the black man can expect to look towards the black woman and gain and like get support, but that that can't be, that not can't, isn't necessarily reciprocated.
I was just gonna say, I feel like it's also like within movements, black women are like, especially like trans and queer black women are not at all, like they're literally not the last on the list, like within feminist circles, like mainstream white feminism, really, really, like it's almost like, oh, it's a problem that you're speaking up, you're being divisive or divisive, and so like you're supposed to wait for your freedom, basically, like wait for your liberation. And I think with like anti-racism liberation movements as well, it's kind of like, well, black men may get their freedom, and then like we'll work on you later. But I think in that model also, like, the expectation is that there's kind of like black patriarchy is kind of reigning over, and that black women kind of don't fit into that model at all. It's just like, oh, when black men are free, we'll be free as
well. You guys know Patrice, Alicia, and Opal? I've heard those names, the three founders, and we know two of those, two of my sisters, they are queer black women. And so it's interestingly enough, hearing queer black women be erased so much when two of the three founders are black queer women.
Even within the black feminist movement, significant amount of the people who created what we consider black feminist theory were queer.
I say.
Or lesbians, yeah.
Also, like, when we talk about music and like the hip hop culture, the portrayal of women there, especially with, like explicit lyricism, but also what David said on 105.1, a radio station that like hip hop radio station, Charlamagne Tha God, one of the radio hosts, was talking about Michelle Obama. It had like nothing to do with like the issue, but he was like, oh, but she's really hot. Like she's got a nice ass. And the other two commentators were like, no, stop. It's like, but it's true, it's a fact. So yeah, so like the sexualization of like the black body.
Go this way, and I'm gonna get you, brother. Was someone over here? Was it someone else?
Yeah. I just like in the like schemas and tropes we're discussing, a lot of them kind of posit black women in relation to black men.
Right.
And so I think that's interesting on a more general level, like because it kind of perpetuates the gendered like hegemony that I think directly affects the representation or lack thereof of like when black women are being killed at the hands of law enforcement, that is not represented in the media.
Mm-hmm.
And so it kind of gets replicated there. And then when we just mentioned queer women, that relation, the relationship of the black woman to man is even, it further erases black women when they're queer because the relationship to men is
mm-hmm.
in question, and that is, again, perpetuated
mm-hmm.
in the media.
And I want to be clear, we often talk about these things in proximity to who we're in community with, right? But when we think about the angry black woman, when we think about the quote-unquote lazy baby mama, when we think about how societal ills are blamed on black women, we are talking about conservative propaganda. We are talking about Reagan. We are talking about the Monahan Report, right? That has then been regurgitated by folks in community. But these are very much white supremacist-born tropes.
Just to add on to what you were saying, also there's an idea that when a woman is performing on stage, that her sexuality is not her own.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the idea that she's being this way because men told her to be this way, when in fact it's her choice to be sexual on stage because this is a power that she is fully owning. That's what I wanted to add on to that.
Mm-hmm. Right here, and then Cecilia.
Yeah, like in regards to like media and presentations of black women, like there's no visibility. Like I think Sandra Bland was like one exception out of all. Like that's the only one that was highly publicized, talked about, and even then it was still kind of like not that publicized.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the other thing is I think about Ferguson and whenever, you know, when he wasn't charged and everyone started, you know, the anger obviously was boiling up and it was on his mother crying to be like, don't do anything bad, like she had to be the one to calm the community. It's always on the black woman to be like, don't do anything rash because then we will be punished for it, kind of thing. But it's always up to her to be like, well, you know what I mean, don't light the gas station on fire because that looks, you know what I mean, like it's always on her,
the black mothering. You guys see that video that went viral where the mama was beating her son for being at a protest or something? And then she was praised for it. I mean, it went viral and every conservative pundit was saying, this is how mama's supposed to be. And then she wound up being homeless, I think, or something happened and there was no support from these same folks who were praising her tough on love actions here and then here.
So this is kind of going off of your point about sort of the erasure of black women in hip-hop culture. Because I feel that like... glasses, okay, Natalie. I don't know. I think what you typically see, especially in music videos, is that there's sort of this valuing of black women's features, but like, how can she not be black at the same time? Like, sort of like the, I guess the idolization of like the Kim Kardashian body type, when it's like that body type has existed, but just hasn't been valued when it looks a certain color.
Here and then here.
Black women as needing to prove their legitimacy. I was thinking about that today. If you read that news story, that story in the news about the doctor that was on the Delta and how she needed to show her credentials and how a white man came from the back of the plane and didn't need to show his credentials at all, and the flight attendant let him go up and see the patient that was in need.
That was so messed up. I was like, do you not see what you're doing there? Like, you're still asking her for help, but you're not like acknowledging that she has experience as a doctor. That was just like a double messed up situation.
And the need to prove this legitimacy is very much connected to both state violence that we experience and our intimate partner violence that we experience, right? Because you have to prove that you're down, right?
Yep.
That you're black enough, that you support your brothers through anything, right? I mean, it reminds me of what we're going through right now with a certain movie that black women may not want to support. And they're like, well, you either have to choose to be black today or a woman today. So which is it? Right?
Mm-hmm.
You had your hand
up. I was just going to talk about issues of colorism for black women. I think that that is very, very big in the community in terms of how women are treated based on the color of their skin, and this value going off of like music videos and things like that. Mm-hmm. How there's value placed on lighter skin tones and just those problems.
Mm-hmm. And this again, isn't just something that is experienced culturally through music and these interpersonal relationships, but studies show that when there's a sister on the stand, that if she's lighter skinned and has certain types of features, she will get a lesser sentence or a less harsh sentence than a sister who is darker skinned or has wider nose or more African features.
Mm. It just made me think about, there was at one point, I guess when I was in high school, there was like a hashtag going around that black girls were putting like team light skin, team dark skin. There's this idea of like categorizing ourselves and like putting ourselves into these I don't even, binaries. Mm-hmm. And then there's also this, what tends to happen is women of all different skin tones try to then fall into the like team light skin because it means of the meaning that's behind it or the positivity that's behind it.
And I think it's important to just mention how this connects so many people, because there are a lot of different cultures that deal with that same issue of colorism. Mm-hmm. And so it goes back to structures, which is a part of what you're really up against as peoples of color in the world. So you're talking about the structure of white supremacy, which, you know, meanders and works in different ways in different cultures, but we're talking about colorism in the black community. In the Japanese community, it's something different. In the Korean community, it's something different. In India, it's something different.
Mm-hmm. And then it's always, just to add on to that, that it's almost always gender, too, right?
Yes. Yes.
Cisgendered,
yeah. Absolutely.
Black man, that sense of colorism is not one that I feel sort of burdened.
Absolutely.
By in the way that cis and trans black women do, right? Yeah. That it can, you can be a dark-skinned brother, a light-skinned brother, it's somewhere... Sandy Brown, and there's not this sort of level of hierarchization, so it's always a gender experience,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right, and it also impacts the way we tell our stories, mm-hmm. or talk about movement work, right? We're getting to a better place now, or, you know, we're being more critical about it now, but I often talk about privilege is not this binary thing, but it's a spectrum, right? And the closer you are to whiteness, then the more privileges that flow through you by your position on the spectrum. And so we hear about Rosa Parks, really brilliant sister. But a lot of us don't know about that first black woman who actually really sat down on the bus, a pregnant young teenage girl who was darker skinned. I think she lives in the Bronx right now, Claudette. And so we don't hear these names because colorism plays a factor in who become the spokespeople for our movement work traditionally.
Also, it just brings you to a point that like how Henrietta Lacks, she pretty much birthed all the vaccines that we have now. Like, she, a black woman, after she died, how doctors went in and took her cells and birthed the vaccine for the flu vaccine, like all these different vaccinations, and how black women pretty much gave birth to existence now. Mm-hmm. And I also want to, my second point is to, like what I talked about in my paper a lot, I think is really critical, is that black women are constantly put against the straight black man hierarchy. And I think that we can't lose sight of that, that it's not, that is, that the erasure comes from the straight black cisgender hierarchy, and that there are different non-binaries within black maleness that are still marginalized, that are still on the shorelines of what we talk about. Mm-hmm. Because I think that, you know, when you talk about these denominations under, if you're not, because all the black men we've talked about are cisgender black male straight males, but when you stray away from mm-hmm. that straight male hierarchy, mm-hmm. you aren't mentioned. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard one story about, even when I talked about in my paper, you had, I can't think of his name right now, but it was a black man. He was in a bar, and two queer white men attacked him. Assad, and they attacked him with racial slurs, and he responded by hitting them with a chair. He was put on trial. They weren't. Nobody talked about this story. because it doesn't fit with that straight black man hierarchy. Mm-hmm. You can't be, if you're not straight and black, you can't be talked about, mm-hmm. because you're detracting from blackness. You're mm-hmm. detracting mm-hmm. from maleness. Mm-hmm. You aren't masculine enough to be in this hierarchy. And I think that's when that sort of that black femaleness, and I think that's when a lot of black queer men and a lot of non-gender non-conforming male bodies, mm-hmm. you know, align with black women on that same issue.
Because mm-hmm, mm-hmm. the reality is, if everyone who isn't a straight black man stayed home,
mm-hmm. there would be
this
no rally.
This wouldn't be shit. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that, like, we were sort of learned was highlighted and illuminated in the Crenshaw piece, for me was, like, you know, that it's easy for me to understand, right, like, why, like, the, like, cis, straight, white man doesn't understand intersectionality, and what is, like, more sorrowful to grapple with is the fact that, like, the black man doesn't, though he may understand intersectionality, the movement feels so vulnerable, I think, that it's like, hold on, people just started to care about the black men in the street, so, like, we can't threaten that, you know, with now bringing in sexuality, with now bringing in gender. Like, there's this idea that, like, the space is vulnerable as it is, and so, like, let's not threaten it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's hard, that's way, at least for me, like, harder to grapple with than the idea that, like, the mainstream sort of, like, white public doesn't understand intersectionality, is that, like, what we sort of read about the feminist and anti-racist organizations who were sort of intentionally keeping out an intersectional gaze for sort of politically strategic or opportunist means.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Can I throw
please,
something?
Please.
Do we want to let people off the hook in that way, though? I just want to mm-hmm. sort of throw that in mm-hmm. there just to ruffle with you a little bit. And by that I mean, should we say we understand why the white cisgendered male doesn't understand intersectionality and sort of leave it at that? Can we sort of talk about that? Like,
no.
Sort of unpack that?
Right, because...
In this moment? Yeah. Or whoever.
I have to say, oh.
There was actually one over here. Do you still want to...
I mean, it's...
He had a hand up
for me. A relatively different subject. I mean, it's still adding to the conversation and being happy to... But basically, I mean, another thing that I just wanted to add is, I guess more about just... continuation of the unfortunate fact that both, I guess, I mean, black bodies in particular, but women are often objectified, and something that I unfortunately often see, and I think this is important to note, I mean, social media is kind of a huge part of our life, and what I think is happening is, it's an ongoing problem, I mean, obviously, but it's an ongoing problem, especially for young people too, I think, because, I don't know if anyone, you know, can relate or has seen the things that I'm referring to, but I often see, like, Vines and Facebook videos and YouTube videos and Instagram videos of white and black men objectifying white and black women in, you know, simple ways, and young people are watching them and they're showing up everywhere, and I think it's just kind of an ongoing, or it's adding to the ongoing issue, as, you know, I don't know if anyone has seen anything of what I'm talking about, but you know, you watch someone walk down the street and you're, like, staring at their features, that's something that is often focused on, and that, it just troubles me, because this is something that, while it's being addressed in a way that is talking about the problem, it's also being addressed in kind of, I guess, reinstating that this very much still exists, and young people are taking advantage of it in a way.
In response to your question, I was actually thinking about it earlier today, because I was having a conversation with my two brothers, who are both Trump supporters, and I was trying to have a conversation with them that as a queer man, I was trying to get through their heads that having them support Donald Trump and Mike Pence, who effectively wants to legalize discrimination against LGBTQ people, and after Donald Trump's sexist comments this past week, just those disgusting comments, that supporting him condones both of their behavior, and I was trying to reconcile with how they've never seen the other side of this. They've never seen the possible ramifications of this. They don't know the taste of it. So how do you separate and how do you draw the line between understanding and accepting it? Because you can't accept it. You can't accept and allow these people to just go blindly, but I guess there has to be some level of understanding that this blindness does exist and that there's, I don't know, just a constant.
I just want to insert really, really quickly, Campbell, yeah. Just to sort of underscore what Sister Sherelle, Sister Abby here said, is that when we think about that Trump moment, why is that Trump moment important about this outrage? I mean, right, we kind of know, and this is what, you know, of course, Sister Simone Sanders, who's going to be coming, I think, in 2 weeks to visit us, mentioned, right, that the outrage about Donald Trump in some ways is an outrage about what? At the core is about what? White women, right? Mm-hmm. That actually, when people say, oh, these comments is this weekend, well, where were we a year ago? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Comments were made about Muslims and immigrant communities and African Americans and a variety of communities. But, and so the question that I'm getting at is that in the context of this, of today's readings, had those comments by Trump actually been directed toward a black woman, would there have been a similar sort of national outrage? Right? Mm-hmm. Or is the only reason that
might
we're
not
sort of
know about
is,
them.
Exactly. That's
mm-hmm.
the question.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because the reality is, Trump has said things like this to black women,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
You know, and we've talked about it already.
Right.
It's not, you know, the fragility of white women, the stock there is really high. Not so much for other sisters. You had your hand up for quite a minute, so I'm going to let you go ahead.
Yeah, kind of going off what you said, like, I've known people that I used to consider close friends, and then when this whole Trump, you know, ran for president and everything happened, and I've been accused of putting my sexuality on my forehead, basically,
mm-hmm.
like, I am gay, and, like, I should stop doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I've been told to, like, basically internalize it and not express who I am, which I think, basically, anyone who's not white, straight, and a male wouldn't, like, understand, to be honest, because you're allowed to, like, the reality is I've seen the locker room talk. Like, when people want to say that's not how people talk in the locker room, that's kind of a lie because it does happen. It, to say, like, to deny, like, talk about it. Talk about the fact that you fetishize black women, Latino women, like, objectify women in every single way, and just, like, it's, like, I don't understand why no one will, like, actually open up and be like, yes, this has been said and it's wrong. You know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's just, yes.
There's a few hands that I want to get to. One of the, because I want to ground us back in terms of thinking through the fact that everyone seems to have a stake in black women and girls being unsafe. It feels like everyone has something to gain when black women and girls are unsafe and are unloved. I want you guys to close your eyes for me for a second. Don't go to sleep. I know you've been here for a minute. And I want you to think about what it feels to mean safe, to be safe. Go to a place where you feel safe and loved. It could be home, you could be at the church, you could be at the crib, you could be at a restaurant, eyes closed. Might be nice and warm, maybe your mother's with you. Okay, open your eyes. What are those places that you envisioned in the safe and warm and loving atmosphere? You can say it out loud.
My grandmother's bedroom.
Grandmother's bedroom.
Parents' bedroom.
Parents' bedroom.
My friend's house.
Friend's house.
Dance studio.
Studio.
Lazy boy chair with my dog.
Lazy boy chair with my dog. Anybody else? Did anybody in their visionings of this safe and warm place where they felt loved and protected, did anyone picture jail cell? Or police showing up at your door? Or body cameras? Or cop cars? Detention centers? Raise your hand if you did, because I want to talk to you after class. Yet, in our neoliberal idea of safety, that's how we're defining what safety means, right? And so when we think about black women, and we think about the Violence Against Women Act, which I think Kim might have wrote about in this essay or another one, we think about who was that act trying to protect. Now, they say that this is for domestic violence victims, this is to protect us, this is, you know, so we won't be assaulted and killed in our homes. But the reality is, when VAWA was enacted, the Violence Against Women Act, more black women went to prison than anyone. And we think about the stories of sisters killed by police violence whose faces were on this video, like Megan Hockaday, who 2 years ago was killed in her home when there was a domestic violence call on her boyfriend. The cop came in 20 seconds later, shot her 4 times, right? And that isn't the only case, right? I'm sure if we look through the data, there's plenty of times where we see when sisters are killed at the hands of the police in their home, it is because of a domestic violence call. So I want us to reimagine what it means to be safe, right? Because through this very neoliberal context, and these are people from across the aisle, this isn't just conservatives, right? This isn't just Republicans or your Trump supporters. This is everyone who says this is what safety means. Our carceral feminisms, to lock up people, to have more police presence, to have bills where we're tougher on crime, and really who are suffering is still Black women, right? So I want us to think about that. Go ahead, because you had your hand up.
Hello. That was one of my points. So I feel like, to your point earlier, Abby, I feel like it's not that you want to let, you know, white cis men off the hook, but I think when you build community with people, you have a certain, like, safety in mind, right? Like, you have, it's supposed to be a safe place, like, you're supposed to be able to kind of, if not be on the same page, like, look out for each other. And I think what's disappointing time and time again is, and I'm sure for Black feminists, but also like other women of color, like when things like the Trump situation happens, you often see white women really angry about it, but not talk about his previous comments about like Muslims or like, you know, like Black communities or like whatever it is. Like there's often this, you know, like, oh, like we, you know, it's we can organize around this and it's being mentioned, but there's no one has your back, right? And I think I'm sure Black women feel this much more than, you know, like brown women or other women of color, but I think it's like a trend where carceral feminism is a thing, right? Like you have white women and just women in general who support other women being locked up, men of color being locked up. Like that's definitely a thing, and I think it comes from not really understanding that if we're in it together, we're really in it together, right? It's not like, oh, we're all women, like, you know, let's go for Hillary or whatever. And then like the next minute, it's not. I think that's the frustrating piece, and so it's like, it's not that you let cis white men off the hook. It's just like it really hurts when it's people who you're trying to live.
And then even,
but shouldn't we be trying to build community with everyone, including cis, gendered, cis white male? I see my role today as, let me just, full disclosure, as being a devil's advocate.
She's an agitator.
I love you guys, but I'm just gonna do that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Even if she didn't believe in herself, she gonna agitate.
Really quickly though, just, and then I'm gonna really shut up. I promise you, baby. But also the flattening out of Black female subjectivity, even when we do talk about Black women. So for instance, when we'll say things, you'll hear people say, you know, they'll say Mike Brown and Tamir Rice and Trayvon Martin and then Sandra Bland, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the way that Sandra Bland comes to stand in for all Black women's experience in a way that actually flattens how we think about Black females, even when it does get entry into the discussion, it's flattened to one narrow particular person that becomes the story of all Black women. Whereas when we talk about police violence against cisgendered Black men, we know a range immediately that, you know, you get Tamir and Trayvon and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But for Black women, it gets reduced to either Sandra Bland or maybe more recently Corinne Gaines, flattening out the range of experiences.
And let's situate Sandra Bland in this. The sister who had moved there for a job at the university, right? Middle class, right? Been very vocal before, right? And so that's easy for people to get behind, or easier. I'm not going to say easy. People tend to get behind Sandra Bland. I see more than the sister in Baltimore. Even folks who I really vibe with were like, I don't know, she was acting up, right? Mm-hmm. There's this kind of gray area with support of other sisters. You mentioned earlier, family in the back with the blue hair, you mentioned earlier poverty, and I think that's really important to revisit. Eleanor Bumpers, whose face was up here, was killed because she was given an eviction notice. She had 4 months of back pay rent, which equaled like $98. Officers came, there was a scuffle, and they shot and killed her in her home, right? And so when we think about poverty, again, and what role that plays in anti-Black state violence against Black women and girls, I think that's a really key to point out, especially when we're talking about Sandra Bland and all the other sisters who go unnamed and unmarched for.
I mean, I come to that conclusion often, because like I'd be lying if I said like, sometimes there isn't that voice in my head.
that's like, oh, well, what about these gray areas? But then the follow-up question is like, well, what created these gray areas? Like, why do these gray areas exist? And they don't exist arbitrarily. Like, they're not just there and have always been there and we must always accept that they're going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Rather, these gray areas exist because we structure our society in such a way that predisposes these ambiguous encounters to happen. Like, we can't remove the political and social culpability of the quote-unquote ruling class from the creation of these gray areas. Like, they exist for a reason. It's because we allow them to exist. It's because we structure society in such a way that engenders their existence.
Come up there with the teaching, bro.
I'm sort of going off of the point about sort of the role of like the white cis male.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's sort of dangerous to assume that they won't understand intersectionality. I think it's very important that they're incorporated like in the conversation, because when you think about power hierarchies, and I don't think that we should have any sort of exclusionary, oh, they won't get, or sort of answering for people, because I think their role in achieving liberation is also important, because when you look at who holds positions of power, it's chiefly white cis males. When you're looking at like legislation and how do we get things passed for, and if even if like the end goal is to abolish prisons, you still need to incorporate like white people in that conversation so that you have actual change and like leverage.
I feel like you have a direct response.
Yeah, just because like I originally made that comment, so like I can, I guess, like shed a little bit more light on it, which is just that I think exactly what you're getting to, which is community. Like, I think as a person who's working class and who organizes around working class, certainly like I want to involve people of other classes and who are cash rich and whatever in my organizing and whatever, but like there is a way in which I expect expect my peers and my community to understand in sort of a more like visceral sense, and like I think like have my back in a way. And so I think that like, yeah, like there's a end goal, and there's like a serious need for people to like sort of like bridge like across our oppressions for sure. But we also can't ignore that, like, though that our communities do exist because of our oppressions in some way, and that we sort of do have to protect each other in those circles. And I think that's what I was getting at in saying that it's hard for me to grapple with when people from our own communities don't stand for us. And that is harder for me to grapple with than when someone outside my community can't. I have it easier, and like, yeah, this can be challenged, but like, I have an easier time understanding when someone who has not related to my experience at all can't get what's happening in my life, right? Like, that's easier. And I'm not saying it's right, and I'm not saying I shouldn't be bridging gaps with them, but like in the sense of feeling as like a like valid way of like pedagogically examining thing, my feeling is that I want my community to like be there for me in a way that I think that like Say Her Name and all our readings this week sort of illuminated that it always isn't there.
And I think that's a totally valid feeling. Like I think, and that's a place to start. I mean, feeling is knowledge. I think my feeling, how I would respond, and sort of throw that out there as a devil's advocate again, is that what I hope and what I dream about is a world where the feeling will be for the person across from you because they're just a human being, and that is the place where you will start, and that is the place where we will enter, and that's part of my connection to saying her name. You know, what does it mean for all of us to be invested in saying her name or his name if he is, you know, his name, just his name. But I was thinking about your point in terms of, you know.
Yeah, kind of going off of that, like what my point is, like how I feel is that if you aren't willing to see the oppression that one body is facing, then maybe we should be building this community. Maybe you aren't down for the real cause. You know, maybe you aren't there for that. So when you're having that conversation of like, oh, say like Kamala was having that conversation with his brothers and like how they're Trump supporters, and him telling them, by you supporting Trump, you are saying that you are against me, that you are against my identity. and they still cannot reconcile with that conversation, then maybe then you have this internal, you know, dialogue where saying, okay, well, maybe you are not really for me. You are not really for myself. You are for the biological connection that we may have, or even at the Black community, you might be down for the racial connection that we may have, but you are not down for the epistemological, psychological, mental battle that I face on a day-to-day basis. And so maybe you should not be building those communities, those bonds, those crossroads with those people.
Ooh, there's so many hands. We've gone wide, right? And so I want us to go a little deep now. Is that cool? So I'm going to still take hands, but I want to ask a question. I'm going to throw it out there. We've talked about safety and, like, how we feel in proximity to folks in our community. We talked about VAWA. We talked about domestic violence. You know, I'm a prison abolitionist, unapologetically, right? But I'll be in spaces with sisters who say, you know, that's dope and everything. And I idealistically, I would love for prisons to be abolished, but my abuser's in jail and I don't want them coming home. Right? Mm-hmm. And so my question I want to pose to you, and this is because I don't have an answer, right? I want you to think about, is how do we create a world where Black women and girls are safe? Black women, girls, femmes, and gender nonconforming folks are safe that doesn't rely on carceral feminisms. Mm-hmm. So think about that as we continue to take hands right here, and then I'm going to come back to you. And then
so, like, directly related to your question, I mean, I don't have an answer either, so I've experienced that it seems to be like a system of priorities where people decide like what gets put in the hierarchy first and last. Like a conversation that I had with my friend last year like popped up where we were talking about racism and social injustice, because that's what we were doing in our writing class. And she was like, oh, I really don't care about this. Like, from where I'm from, like, we just don't care about these types of stuff. And I was like, I don't get it. Like, you're a woman and you're a minority. And you don't care. And then she goes into this whole thing about, like, yeah, I'm from China, and, like, not to say that this is, like, representative of the whole thing, but, like, this is her opinion and, like, what she sees. She was like, yeah, like, it's hard to even get, like, a house, right? So people are competing in this, like, very tight economy where, like, they prioritize getting a job over fighting for social justice issues. So, like, that just adds to the question of how can we make safe spaces when people are constantly prioritizing their like, needs.
Which is important, right? Because we don't want to get to the promised land raggedy and broke and hungry, right? So it means how do we empower our folks to survive the journey to the promised land, is what I'm hearing. Let me see your hands up because I want to catch people who I haven't heard from. So I'm going to go to you, then to you, then to you. And then we'll sweep this way because I haven't heard from some of these voices. So these two, and then over here.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
My point was actually more about, Abby, your question about how to reach across the table to the white cis man. And I get that that's the ultimate goal. I also see part of the social justice movement as a space for collective mourning, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if you want everybody in the room when you're doing collective mourning. Kind of responding to the question that you said about how do we make a world where Black women and girls are safe, and earlier you had said that it seemed like everyone has a stake in Black women and girls not being safe, which seems like counterintuitive to some of the readings we've done. Like, I know the Say Her Name brief mentions that, like, when Black women and girls are victims of police violence, because they are kind of the domestic centers of their communities, that, like, when they are harmed, it harms everyone in the community. It harms the men around them too. And then I know one of the Audre Lorde readings that we did earlier on anger, like, emphasizes that, like, as a Black woman, like, she as a woman can't be free until all women are free, and as a Black person can't be free until all Black people are free. And I think, like, maybe part of the answer for creating a world in which Black women and girls are safe is, like, recognizing that, in fact, it's, like, the opposite. Like, everyone does have a stake in Black women and girls being safe. And then, like, I recognize that there's some, like, it can be problematic to then say, like, oh, well, like, my safety depends on it too. So like that's why I'll fight for it. And it shouldn't be that. It should just mm-hmm. be fighting for Black women and girls solely mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. they're mm-hmm. Black women and girls. Like it shouldn't be like, oh, like I'm also related. So like it's for me. Like I don't know mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Right.
And, like dealing with that
yeah.
as well. And then like kind of responding, I guess, to like reaching out to like people or to like white cis heterosexual men, and we've been talking about like feelings as like valid and like feelings as knowledge, which like I do agree with, but then like on the other hand, to play like devil's advocate, kind of like how you were saying, then like what if like a white cis man goes, oh well, like according to my worldview, like I don't see racism, I don't see sexism, I don't see these things, I don't feel that these things are a problem, and then like how do you contend, like how do you contend with that and like go from a place where like when their worldview hasn't included these things, how do you make it include those things and like change their feelings and like can you?
You don't. I usually
my practice is not to, but
exactly.
I want to respond very specifically to one of your points really quickly before we pivot over here. With a really quick anecdote. I had a sister tell me about her great aunt who was a field hand back in the day when slavery was abolished, but they still were sharecroppers. She killed her husband, who was abusive, right? She went to jail. The white man who owned the land went the next day and got her out. Not because he cared about the sister being lost to the system, but he said, she's my best field hand. I need her back in the fields tomorrow. And she was, right? So I don't want us to mistake and care for
mm-hmm.
folks' need of Black women's labor, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where we're thinking about these things in a really, I want us to be really rigorous in our understanding around what the community actually needs and wants and how they support Black women, right? So needing and wanting Black women around to do labor does not then translate to I care for you and I care about your emotional well-being. Over here.
I don't think we should be let off the hook in terms of being educated on Black women's struggles in particular, because like before, honestly, before the readings for this class, I'm studying biological and cultural diversity. I've taken a lot of classes on race and whatnot throughout my time here. But honestly, before this, I thought maybe Black women had, you know, a place of privilege over Black men because they didn't, you know, they didn't have the same stereotypes. They didn't, you know, as far as I knew, they didn't suffer from the same stereotyping and issues, like with the police and everything. And that it was totally eye-opening to actually realize the truth of the intersectionality and how they're actually, you know, Black women are actually doubly disadvantaged. They aren't, you know, they don't have some sort of privilege in any way because they're women. And I guess the fact that I could study, you know, issues relating to race with this song and like not realize I didn't kind of have that ignorant assumption just goes to show how hidden, I mean, I honestly think like the level of discrimination you face is directly correlated with how invisible your struggles really are, because I just had no idea. But I can't pretend at all to relate on an emotional level to, you know, any movement for Black women or anything like that, but I totally understand now on an intellectual level after reading all this how important it really is, and so I certainly don't think it's something, like I think the issue is that people, you know, don't know about it, and it shouldn't take like 4 years of studying, you know, biology and race or like the diversity or whatever to come to that realization as a, you know, white man.
Can I just respond really, really
sure.
quickly? I keep saying, I don't know how to shut up.
It's
because
all right.
I'm
it's all right.
I'm
it's all right.
I try.
Okay.
This is the critical work and labor that I need. But really, really quickly, I mean, so because the question that's really being asked here is an ethical question. How do we do the work when we're not invested in it, or when, how do we do the work when we don't see a direct sort of return, right? Where it's not about me. This is the question that Emily was asking. But really, we already do that, right? That human beings have been doing animal activism for hundreds of years, right? And it's actually easier for people to do labor and organizing work around chihuahuas than it is to do around Black women.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about animal rights and animal labor, we don't really have an investment. It's not about we do that because we think it has a direct impact on our lives. We do it because of a kind of ethical imperative. Right, but it's something about the historic dehumanization of Black women in particular that disallows us to even have that conversation. So there's a kind of ethical willingness to defend animals, knowing that you don't got to be an animal. You don't got, you know, that's not your story. But yet, you never think, well, you know what? Lassie, I can't fuck because that what that got to do with me, right? But so very often when non-black people, and particularly non-black women, have this conversation, we don't talk about it in the same terms. Very quickly, also in the same way we can't flatten out black women's identity, we can't flatten out white men's identities either, right? Like Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are two very different white men. And truth be told, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, some might argue, right, that, you know, some, and I'm not saying me, I'm not certainly not endorsing anyone in particular, but many would say, I'd rather fuck with Bernie Sanders than I would Hillary Clinton, right? And so it's important for us to be careful not to talk about cisgendered white men in one flattened static way, recognizing that there's a polarity and diversity of experience in that experience.
Because people have to get uncomfortable. Yeah. And sometimes it's about, you know, giving up some of those cushy things that you're used to because of your privileges, right? When it comes to animal rights, if you're a vegan and you don't wear fur, there's but so much discomfort you're going to experience being an animal rights activist, right? But that's very different. We're talking about racial and gender equality. Go ahead, Sister Katrina. Wait, to talk for a second.
Well, just back to your question about, like, what can we do to make black women and black girls feel safe. You know, as someone who also believes in the abolition of jails in prisons, I think that, like, there has to be a focus shift to mental health because, like, disregarding what is criminalized, such as like sex working and certain types of drug use and drugs, things that pertain to black women specifically. Mm. If all of that goes away and like the bad things like murder and like abusers of these black women that we want to protect, and like that's the problem, and we talked a little bit about this with Mark Lamont Hill, and like how, like, if that becomes a problem, then like the argument could be that, like, and it's not excusing their actions, but that's a mental issue, and like incarcerating them rather than getting them mental health attention will actually contribute to like the danger that those type of people like would contribute to society once they got out, because like the damage that's done to people who already suffer from mental health and mental illnesses in prison is so severe. Like, I mean, we saw it with Khalif Browder, like as soon as, like he got out and he committed suicide because of the trauma that he endured in prison, you know. So I would argue that the shift just has to like go towards mental health and mental health facilities.
Gotcha. And it sounds like some of that disrupting the abuse to prison pipeline. Yeah. A little bit too. Mm-hmm. All right. Hands up. Let me see who I haven't heard from. Okay. You two, then you two. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. So I just going back to this question of like, what does it look like to make the safe spaces for the multiply marginalized in our present? And I think I agree, like, with the idea that the end goal is the relating based on our humanity solely. But I think what the present requires for us to get to that point is to understand how our varying oppressions differentiate or kind of separate how we are perceived as humans and how some people, based on their oppressions, are perceived as less human. And we can't get to the point without understanding how our differing oppressions relate to one another. Mm. But I think, yeah, a lot about like what Mark Lamont Hill was saying is the steps towards restorative justice. There was something he said that really resonated with me about his on prison abolition. He was that like, he was saying like, I don't wanna see like black folks in jail, and I also don't wanna see George Zimmerman in jail because I don't believe in jail. Mm. And thinking about like what that meant, I think the strides to take
are toward understanding that it's the humanity that links us, but we need to understand first that, like, there are the way that some people are affected by the problems that prevent us from getting there need to be addressed in order for all of us to, you know, get to that point.
Okay.
And I think that was really, that I just remember him saying that and being like, it was very powerful and complicated to grapple with, but
yes.
But definitely worth thinking about. And I think restorative justice as a framework to think within and moving forward is like essential.
Gotcha. So these are going to be our last three comments, or we're going to go here. Is it okay if we'll get you in? And then, so 1, 2, 3, 4, and we'll have to put a cap on it there. Is that all right, guys? Because I want to respect your time.
Yeah, okay. I kind of have two things, but I'll try to keep it short. So kind of responding to the question about, you know, how do we make the world safer for Black women and girls, that made me think about something that we were talking about in one of my other classes, that a theorist was talking about as a way to, like, kind of foster community between radically different people is the idea of, like, having contact between different groups. So I think that to sort of, I guess, maybe even bring in people that we might have, like, a really hard time kind of thinking about how to include, such, you know, as we've been talking about how white cis gay straight guys, like, they might, it's hard to kind of bring them in because they might not have the same, like, kind of visceral understanding of what it, like, why people are protesting and why people need change in the world. I think that starting to, like, lose my train of thought. I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
I think that one of the ways to kind of bring people in is by just maybe not in, like, a, like, kind of very, like, intellectual, like, activist sort of setting, but in more of a casual setting where people just kind of, I guess, relate to each other, like, casually on, like, a regular basis. And another thing that I just thought of quickly about the idea of restorative justice and kind of also focusing on mental health. I think that another kind of component of that is that, the nature of what it, like, means to have someone being, like, removed from society because they pose a danger either to themselves or to other people. I think that you also have to really think about what sort of environment are you going to create in that enclosed place.
Mm-hmm.
Put it in your response papers, too. When you feel this overflow, you can't
get
it out because we got to wrap it up, right? So you
Sorry.
Gotta be quick. 10, you want to respect your colleagues, you want to do quick 10-second commercials for brevity's sake, and
I
you
should.
Want to throw the rest in your response papers, and you're going to email these two wonderful organizers
yes.
and scholars and artists afterward, telling them how thankful you are, and then continuing the dialogue that way, too. Yes, Kamala.
Just quickly in response, sorry. I think contact can also be harmful because it's used as a justification. My aunt that lives in Jackson, Mississippi, is firm in believing that racism doesn't exist there because of a program that churches do in Jackson where they switch the actual churches so that Black folk and white folk would mix. And so that contact she uses as a justification for racism not existing. So I think it can also be harmful.
Yeah.
I guess it depends on, like, what you
Actually, if I can you close it up? Because I know you had your hand raised, you haven't spoken. Do you want
to
close us out?
Appropriation of property and prison for the people in power that
You trying to start up another class?
Right.
Okay, yeah. You want to close? Oh, Abby.
No, I don't want to close. Oh. I want to thank you guys for your time really, really quick because I want to respect everybody else's time. As the artist here, or one of the artists, I just want to say that part of why I sing, part of why I create music is because I want to cultivate empathy for Black female lives. And that's really, really, I take that very seriously and it's very important to me. And so it's how I want to make it so that you or anybody, somebody else, not just like you, but anybody else, won't say that they don't have an emotional sort of investment in someone who looks like me. And so I encourage you guys to keep thinking about these really important and interesting, you know, issues. And, you know, challenge yourselves. You know, challenge yourselves and challenge each other. Because it's about taking down and dismantling these structures that impact our lives and the ones that intersect all of them. Those tentacles that, you know, sort of wrap around all of us.
Ashe. Abby's doing this event here on the 20th, so you guys are getting little placards for that. Sure.
We're going to take some pictures. Is that okay?
Yeah, yeah. If you're on Twitter, I am awkward_duck. So if you guys want to tweet at me, awkward_duck. Y'all don't judge me for my thirst trap.
And Abby, how can they contact you?
Mine is really boring. It's just Abby Dobson Sings.
That's, and my email is connected to that, okay?
And my email is abbydobsonsings@gmail.com.
But wait, as promised, we got to close out Turns Up, okay?
Yeah.
Is that cool? Stand up. Stand up for me. Yeah, sure. We can record this part. Sorry if you guys didn't get a comment or a question, but I really appreciate what you brought today. You guys are really brilliant, and I feel encouraged that you guys are doing this work so that I can chill out 2 years from now as you guys kind of take up the mantle and do the organizers. All right? So we're going to do a side again, but we're going to do it in three parts, okay? We're going to start low, and I know we're in an academic building, but we're going to act like we're in the streets, so we're going to go high. Is that cool?
Yeah.
Is that cool with you, Professor?
Yes, we're
going to
turn the lights
out. Oh, cool. Oh, yes, turn
it's
the lights
out. It's a better visual.
Y'all cool getting loud?
So,
again, this is a love letter Asada wrote to the movement. This is our commitment to each other, to the allies in the space, that we're going to hold it down, and that we got each other's back. Left, right, side to side. Right, Abby? This is my rider right here. All right. Real low. It is our duty to fight for our freedom.
It is our duty to fight for our freedom.
It is our duty to win.
It is our duty to win.
We must love and support each other.
We must love and support each other.
We have nothing to lose but our chains.
We have nothing to lose but our chains.
It is our duty to fight for our freedom.
It is our duty to fight for our freedom.
It is our duty to win.
It is our duty to win.
We must love and support each other.
We must love and support each other.
We have nothing to lose but our chains.
We have nothing to lose but our chains.
The last time for these sisters on my hoodie here, all right? It is our duty to fight for our freedom.
It is our duty to fight for our freedom.
It is our duty to win.
It is our duty to win.
We must love and support each other.
We must love and support each other.
We have nothing to lose but our chains.
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 Ashe.
Ashe.
Thank you, family. Y'all wear me, baby. It's easy when you get poked on the discussion like that. Did you say runway?
No,
you
said November.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, runway. Runway. Now. I mean, I can see that too. She does. She be singing in these 6-inch heels.
Oh, see, yeah, no, you, I was chills and everything.
You should say what she had her heels.
That's 9 o'clock. I just want to get a photo. Our visitors right here.
Roll Tide.